We're going to talk to Elizabeth Corey, Rachel Corey's cousin. She's going to introduce herself and talk about her relationship with Rachel.
Yeah, I just wanted to introduce myself a little bit. Yes, I've lived in Atlanta for 10 years. I'm Rachel's first cousin, and even though she grew up in Washington State and I grew up in Ohio and Virginia, we saw each other every summer in Minnesota. Our grandmother had a cabin on a lake in Minnesota, and our extended family got together every summer. So I feel very close to her. I was very close to her, and I saw her grow up. She is our baby cousin. She's 8 years younger than I am. So for a lot of our lives, she was really too little for me to take seriously as my friend. She was more of the little cousin that was scampering behind us. But I did get to know her as she was starting to become a woman, and I do grieve that I won't get to know the woman she was going to become. When she left for Rafa, she emailed me. We were close enough that she did want me to be one of her emergency contacts, and so when she told me, asked me to be her emergency contact, that was actually the first I heard she was going to Rafa, so I was like, wow, okay. So I immediately signed on to the ISM distribution list, and I began following what she was doing, and she frequently sent emails to her mother and to our family, so I followed pretty closely what she was doing from week to week.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you'd met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate.
As Beth continues, she attempts to demonstrate that the murder of her cousin was premeditated. She retells Rachel's story, the events of the day she was killed, March 17th.
I think most of us here basically know what happened to her, but just to summarize again, they had been there in front of the house of a man who's a physician, or perhaps a pharmacist, I think is more appropriate. They had been there for 2 hours already before she had been killed. And they had already been talking to him. And in fact, she had been learning Hebrew. There was a retired IDF general or an officer who had been teaching her Hebrew things to say that would appeal to their consciences. Like, what would your mother think of you? And she was learning to say things like that. I don't know if she had the opportunity to practice it that day. But she had already spoken to this soldier driving the bulldozer, and they had already been there for 2 hours. They had already been negotiating. She was wearing a bright orange fluorescent jacket and had a bullhorn, and there's really no way to believe that this could have been an accident. And to me, that's backed up by the fact that there was no sign of remorse or fear or, you know, afterwards. The Israeli soldiers did nothing to help her after she was hurt. And indeed, the next day when people came back to the memorial site to plant flowers where she was killed and to memorialize her, they tried to break up the memorial service with tear gas and tanks. And to me, that doesn't sound like there was any accident or any feeling of there was a mistake. And this also comes from eyewitness reports, which are widely publicized and easy to access if you want to do that. And also, ironically, Rachel's father was in Vietnam, and he had a similar job of using bulldozers to move earth in Vietnam. And he knew that bulldozers, when pushing dirt, go very, very slowly. You can see someone and move out of the way or stop pretty easily. He also knew as a soldier that it was never appropriate to hurt a civilian in that context, and that was for the ethics of being a soldier.
As her foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? And did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day?
We're listening to Elizabeth Corey, cousin of Rachel Corey, slain ISM activist. The following day, March 19th, at a memorial service that was being held for Ms. Corey, Israeli forces unleashed tear gas and concussion grenades and fired shots into the air. The same bulldozer that she was killed with was driven past the scene by Israelis. 10 people were hospitalized after that incident. You're listening to Currents of Resistance.
But what I wanted to say today is that I just wanted to say something about what Rachel has come to symbolize in our public discourse. Since her death, she's become basically a lightning rod for our public discussion and how people respond to me or to our family says everything about how they view the situation in Israel and Palestine, and it says everything about what they read or if they read anything at all. So anyone who's been following conversations on the internet or letters to the editor know that there's all kinds of different ways that people interpret the story of Rachel Corey, and she was a martyr and a saint, or she was a traitor, she was a terrorist, and all kinds of other cruel things that you could use to say something mean about a woman. But there was a really wonderful article this week in the New York Observer, May 1st, that summarizes a lot of that quite well. And one of the things in there that was said that I think is very appropriate way to think about this is a woman named Hilda Silverman, who is a member in Boston of Jewish Women for Justice in Israel and Palestine, said, quote, "I didn't anticipate that anyone would be able to come up with a rationalization for what happened to Rachel, but she's been treated as rape victims have been treated." And I do think that's a way to think about it. And why? Well, human beings blame the victim because that way we can distance ourselves from the claim that that person's suffering has on us. If it's the victim's fault, then we don't have to take responsibility for what happened. If the victim is stupid or evil or made some sort of mistake, then because we're good and smart and know better, it would never happen to us. And so that's kind of how that psychology works. So this is, of course, not only what people are doing about Rachel, but this is the way the U.S. and Israel treats Palestine. We blame the victim for its own suffering. So the author of this article, Philip Weiss, says, you know, this, because she's been such a lightning rod for this discussion, a lot has turned on her character and her motivation. And so he goes, very well then, let me tell you about her character. So I'm going to tell you about her character. Rachel Corey was an intelligent, graceful, artistic, witty, playful, passionate young woman who understood herself to be a citizen of the world and who always stood on the side of the oppressed, the discarded, the disenfranchised, and the alienated. As a child, she adopted every injured and abandoned animal she came across, even those who had been so traumatized by other humans' treatment of them that they were untrusting of humans and therefore difficult to love. She had this one dog in particular that was insane and in fact even attacked her brother, but she would refuse to give it up because she was so devoted to this dog and no one else would take When she was 10 years old, in 1989, she delivered a speech that she wrote herself from the floor of the Washington State Legislature, pleading for an end to world hunger by the year 2000. And she was pleading for those who are in developed countries to reach out to children starting in developing countries. And she said, we've got to understand that we are them and they are us. 10 years old. In seventh grade, she organized a walkout with her fellow students in support of the teacher's strike. And it was quite funny because she organized this without telling her parents. And her mother, Cindy, was out of town, and her father, Craig, was getting ready to go on a business trip, and he was leaving her in charge of her older brother and sister, and she finally confessed that she'd organized this walkout for the next day, and he wasn't going to be in town, and he was starting to freak out, like, no, you can't do this, you can't organize a walkout in the middle of school, and she's like, I have to. No, you don't. I have to. No, you don't. I have to. Why? Because I called the press. So, she did organize a walkout. In high school, she visited Russia. Her parents always had exchange students. They had like 6 or 7 exchange students over the course of their lives, and they had some Russian exchange students, and she went over to Russia, and this was very soon after the fall of the Soviet Union, and she was just so amazed by the poverty and devastation there, and at the same time, the hospitality of the Russian families that welcomed her. And she compared that to her experience living with the Palestinian families that she stayed with as well, that in the midst of all of that devastation, they could be so giving and generous and hospitable. And it shamed her because she was so had so much privilege herself. In college, she worked for 3 years in a mental health crisis center, where she worked with the very severely mentally ill. After 9/11, she became very, very active in the peace movement there. She was a leading activist. And so for me and for our family, it seems logical that she should have gone to Palestine. Because this was her whole life, was always sort of being on the side of the underdog. Once she became aware of the terrible suffering of those under the occupation, once she understood that she could do something to help them, she felt she had no choice, she had to go. So she did. So that was her motivation, because that was her character. She was not an anti-Semite. She was not anti-American. She was not a supporter of violence. She was strongly committed to nonviolence. And she was not a naive, unwitting dupe of terrorists. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was standing for peace and justice.
Across the green line, back to the open shore. Did you think this was just another day in a dirty war? And when you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed, one more home destroyed?
You've been listening to Atlanta Indie Media's Currents of Resistance. That was Elizabeth Corey, cousin of slain ISM activist Rachel Corey. For more in-depth coverage of Ms. Corey's killing, you can find it at PAL Solidarity, PALSolidarity.org, or electronicintifada.net.
The music you've been hearing tonight is Song for Rachel, available for download at davidrovics.com. For more information about Atlanta Indie Media, visit atlanta.indiemedia.org. Your questions and comments are always welcome at currentsofresistance@wrek.org.
You ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself for pointing out that you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other side the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation. The very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. will come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army ruling by decree.